It's an honor and a privilege to work with Crystal and everyone on the Extreme History Project. What an amazing project that has been. What a gift it's been to our community and to myself and to, I think, just everyone in the state, really. It's been an innovative and forward-thinking group, the Extreme History Project. Our good friend Marsha Fulton, who can't be here this evening, I want to shout out to her. You know, I'm really excited about the project on the Bozeman Creek. That creek there, and all of these creeks flowing on this east side of the Gallatin that we know of as the East Gallatin watershed, and those were all spots that were collectively known as the Chokecherry Rivers, Chokecherry River. And so it'll be interesting to see how we can weave a lot of that ancient history into what we know about today's Bozeman Creek. And I'm very thankful for Mountain Time Arts for their work on that. And of course, water is so critical to all of us. And here in Montana, it plays an even larger role because there's so little of it. And a lot of my talk is going to be focused on that. If I could just start off maybe by talking, give a little bit of background on myself. And I'm from Crow Agency, Montana. Grew up there in the 1970s and 80s when we had three TV stations. And my mother was a single parent and was a hardworking lady. And so I was kind of a latchkey kid. I would come home and let myself in the house. And she was the child of boarding school parents. Both my grandparents on my mother's side had been sent to boarding school. Lost our language while they were there. Lost most of their culture. Lost a lot of the connections to their communities. And so my mother, in a lot of ways, was orphaned from her traditions, and I inherited that. So as a kid growing up in Montana, I knew very little about Montana. I knew very little about my tribe. Knew very little about the history of Montana. And as a consequence of that, I think I felt I knew very little about myself. And so as I entered into my academic career, that was one of the things that I thought I wanted to focus on is exactly where am I in Montana? Because I watched TV, I grew up watching TV, and I knew everything about those three networks. And we were watching some show the other night pardon the pun, I guess. And I think it was an English show. Oh, it was Call the Midwife. And, you know, it was midnight and the epilogue came on, you know, where they play the national anthem. And it just took me right back, you know, those great memories as a kid when the national anthem used to come on and then everyone signed off at midnight and the world went dark. Not so much anymore, huh? I remember we would turn up the radio to get to Oklahoma station, especially on Friday and Saturday nights, and you know, sometimes they would have mystery theater on there. And so I knew a lot about popular culture from those elements. I knew a lot about American mainstream culture, and I sucked it all up. I was a good reader. I read as much as I could. I read the newspaper every day. I remember I came here to Bozeman High. I was sitting in the library as a senior. This was 1990. Sitting in the library reading the newspaper, and one of the students said, "Are you almost done with that?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm still reading." He said, "Well, I've been watching you." He said, "You've been reading that for a while. You don't read every single article, do you? I mean, nobody reads every single article, do they?" And, you know, for the first time it hit me, I said, "You know, I do read every single article in the paper." And he was just dumbfounded, you know. And so I went along, like I said, absorbing and consuming as much pop culture as I could, learning everything that I could. I mean, about mainstream music, art, literature, knew zero about my tribe. Looked for it, tried to read about it, tried to find out about it. There's some out there, but always left deflated, always left a little bit hollow. And so I began to reach out to people back home a little bit more, began to participate a little bit more in some of the stuff that was available to me, and began to engage in ceremonies, all the different ceremonies that were available to me. Became familiar with them. Started singing. I didn't start singing Plains Indian music until I was 17 years old. And I can say my life has never been the same since then, because of the community that allowed me to engage within. Going to powwows, singing with the intertribal group here at MSU, meeting all the different tribes from throughout the state, finding this remarkable commonality that everyone shared, this ability to laugh at the drop of a hat, to strike up conversation, you know, about pretty much anything under the sun, you know, very disarming individuals. And I was curious about that. What are these qualities about these Plains Indian people that I'm getting to know, and the people who I grew up with back home, my family members? What makes us unique? What makes us different? And what is it about over here on the Great Plains in Montana that is so special? And so that's where I bring to this lecture, I guess, this evening. It's a little bit of what I've discovered, I feel like I've found out. And I have to say, it starts with the medicine wheel. You know, the first time I went there, I must have been about 7 years old that I could remember. And I went with my uncle. He took us up there, up to the Bighorn Mountains. It's about 10,000 feet in the air. And that's the picture of it inset there. And I remember him saying, this is a very sacred, special place. And I never really knew how old it was. I guess I never really wanted to know or needed to know exactly how old it was. I just knew it was very old. And I had a lot of respect for my uncle. And if he told me it was sacred, I believed him. And he was a sun dancer. And you can see this sun dance here. That sun dance is practiced by... Whoops. Where's that light? There it is. This sun dance here, I believe, is probably either Shoshone, possibly Cree. But all the tribes of the Great Plains practice this. And it comes from this here. All of the Sundance priests, as I guess they're referred to, talk about this wheel, talk about how important this wheel, the one in the Bighorns and the ones we find all over, are to this ceremony here. And in fact, taken almost identically from the structure, my adopted dad back home in Crow, he has a Sundance that he puts on in July. It's after the Crow Shoshone one, and it's just a Crow one, and it's a 24-spoke one, and so follows the exact same pattern as this wheel. And so that's how old, and this is the oldest, by the way, the oldest archaeological structures that we know of in Montana. So if we want to know about ancient Montana culture, we have to understand what these things are, what they meant to people. I want to plug here for Ivy Marriott, my good friend. She's a Bozemanite. This is her new book. It's going to be out for purchase here very shortly, if it's not already. And so she wrote her doctoral thesis on the bighorn medicine wheel. This is a photo of the medicine wheel at the morning of the solstice. She said that this red light here is actually coming from the cairn. So who knows exactly what that light is, but pretty special. This is the wheel itself reflected in the sky. And in her book, she details a great amount of what the wheel can tell us. In fact, so sophisticated and so intricate, so broad, that a lot of it escapes me, to be honest. I don't feel like I have the brain to understand a lot of the stuff that she's going into there. It's high tech, which is really amazing to me too at the same time, because it seems like such, of course, a low tech tool. So I'm going to encourage folks to go out and purchase that book if you get a chance. Here's another one that's out, and I use this. This was an inspiration to me. I actually haven't read the book, I'm sorry to say. But looking for the book, and I was told about the book. Haven't had time and been able to purchase it yet. This is fairly new. And in this book, this lady outlines a lot of the medicine wheel structures that we find in Canada, and there are many, many of them. And so there are a lot of mostly very unique. All of them are unique. They have their own structures about them. No two are exactly the same. Not all of them are circular. Some of them are more effigies, look to be effigies of people on the ground. But nevertheless, the wheels are a prominent landmarks that you find all throughout the Northern Plains. And in fact, this is one map. This is just a few of the wheels on here. Like the last slide said, there's over 100 in this area here. Here's the famous one on Medicine Mountain. It's actually in Wyoming. And when you're looking from Medicine Mountain to the north, you can see all through. You can see the big snowy mountains here in central Montana. I believe, I don't know, I don't think you can see the crazies, because from where you're at on Medicine Mountain, the priors are blocking the view. And from Medicine Mountain to the west, you can see in the Bighorn Basin. You can't really look too far to the east because there's mountains in the way there, but you've got quite a view from up there. There's a few other wheels that we find south of that, but the vast majority are found Montana, North Dakota, Canada. Now, what's the difference between them and teepee rings? Because teepee rings, there's like 5 million of them that have been found on the Great Plains, from Montana to the Dakotas up into Canada. Well, the main difference is that they don't have cairns. That's probably the most obvious difference. And if you're going to define a medicine wheel as a circle of rocks with cairns coming from the center of it, then that's the most basic definition of it. Then you'll find a lot of them here. And what does it mean? What do they mean? Here's one. Isn't that something? This is at Majorville. It's called the Majorville Medicine Wheel in Canada, just across the border, north of Montana. This one is out on the Great Plains. And a lot of them, like the Moose Medicine Wheel, Moose Mountain Medicine Wheel one, I think that's in Canada. From the photos that I've seen on that, the landscape behind him is just absolutely awe-inspiring. Literally, you can view hundreds of miles, apparently, seemingly, as the land falls away. And I was thinking of Judith Gap, some of these other places in Montana, where you don't actually have to be up on a mountain to see the land fall away. It just goes down. You can just see it go off and on. And these are the places where the wheels somehow make the most sense. One thing that we know about the culture that we find within the wheels is that the people who lived in that arena did not stay in the same place all year round. They moved around, especially here in Montana. We find no year-round habitation sites. In Douglas MacDonald's book, 11,000 Years of Hunting and Gathering, one of the things that we need to remember is that people weren't hunting and gathering for 11,000 years all throughout the North American continent. In fact, most people had turned to agriculture 2,000 years ago. Corn, beans, and squash became staples. People learned how to bring them up from Mesoamerica into the Americas, into continental U.S. The folks, the cultures that you see thriving that didn't have that agricultural, those agricultural products are cultures like in California, where the climate is so nice and you have such an abundance of water and wild foods that people are able to live literally off the fat of the land. And, you know, those same things could be said about Montana, except not to that extent, given the fact that it snows here every month out of the year. And we don't know if it's going to be 60 degrees in December or if it's going to be 30 degrees in June. But we take it because we know that that's just the way it is here. You know, there's one of the things that one of the ads that came up, you know, recently, Montana's not for sale. You know, well, actually, Montana is for sale, but that don't mean that you can change the weather, though. You know, you can buy whatever you want, but the sky is going to behave on its own terms. And you know, I think that's kind of funny when you think about it, though, because there's so much truth to the fact that, you know, a lot of people have seen Montana, big dreams in Montana for a long time. You know, drive up to Ringling sometime. There was a guy that came through there by the same name who had big plans for that. Here in Bozeman, we're pretty good at pulling off big plans. But mostly throughout the state, the plans have been small. And a lot of it is because of you know, the difficulty of our climate, of our weather, of our soil, of our lack of water. And my tribe was one of those groups that became these nomadic, or these folks who moved camp, as they say, year-round. Culture is a gamble with nature, Marshall Solon's anthropologist. I love that quote. And you can apply it, of course, to any cultural institution and any group. For the Plains Indians here in Montana, that image there kind of sums a lot of it up. You know, they gave up whatever culture that they had before they came here and learned how to live in Montana. And so my tribe took the gamble. And, you know, one thing I've learned is that as a lecturer, I could stand up here and lecture, and it would be great. You know, everyone would enjoy that. You'd get some good things out of the lecture. But you wouldn't quite be as affected if you heard a story or a number of different stories. And so I thought, well, why not use my tribe and tell their story? Because their story is very interesting, has a lot of unique characteristics that show how we adapted to Montana. My tribe took the cultural gamble when we came to Montana. We originally were at Cahokia. And the reason why we know that is because our linguists have traced our language back there. We speak a Siouan language, and that larger group came from the Cahokan Mounds, where everything, where an empire was created, and it was based on corn, the corn that had come up from Mexico and found its way to the beautiful in rich soils on the Mississippi floodplain down there along St. Louis, around by where present-day St. Louis is located. At that time, Cahokia was the largest city in the world based on corn. And so a surplus of agricultural products is what allowed this economy to flourish and for all of these mounds to be built. And, of course, there's social institutions that are also created that help to embolden that, that help all of it to make it all work, if you will. What exactly are the were the cultural institutions at Cahokia? We probably could make some pretty good guesses about the general structure of those institutions, assuming that we have leaders on top. Why did those people get there? How did they get there? Was it religious? Seems to be that's, when we look at human history, a lot of times folks who rise to the top of those particular economies have some type of special ethereal ability that is they have been imbued with. But be that as it may, my tribe rejected all of that, apparently, and their ancestors, and left Cahokia and took their corn seeds with them and came up into the Great Lakes region. It was already inhabited by Ojibwe, people who were living off of wild rice and walleye and all of the other rich products of the Great Lakes region. Made our way into Minnesota, still keeping our corn with us. And according to our legends, we had a leader who had a dream, fasted and had a dream on one of the Great Lakes, on the banks of the Great Lakes. And his dream told him to head to the west to find a place where the sacred tobacco seed would grow. And so he left, and a lot of the people who lived with them at that particular time decided to follow him for whatever reason. They believed in his dream. And so he came out, they followed him. He took a long time, years, as they traveled with their seeds, corn seeds. And we know this because of archaeological evidence shows that my tribe had a village on the eastern end of the Yellowstone River near present-day Glendive. What's the name of that? The Hagen site. And it was at that site that they found Crow pottery. That was another one of the cool things that my tribe used to do. We used to make pottery. We don't do that anymore. We hadn't done that for hundreds of years since we left the Hagen site. But we also had corn at the Hagen site. And we tried to bring our corn into Montana and plant it. And we took it up here along the Elk River here, this place just about 10 miles east of present-day Livingston. Now it's known as Sheep Mountain. That's the Yellowstone River down there. Flowing, you can see these trees here. This is actually in March when I took this photo a few years ago. These are a few friends. And this was the site of the Fort Parker, the original Crow agency, as this was part of the original Crow Indian Reservation back in the 1850s and 60s. Just a few miles downstream here, the river bends and you come across some real high cliffs. And it's a really cool little area. It's one of the coolest little areas on the Yellowstone. You all know what I'm talking about. When you're driving, though, it's not that fun. When you get across there and you come down and you wind around and there's a little place called Springdale. And my tribe called that place where the corn died. And that was the final name and the final resting place for that corn. Because we decided, I think, after that incident that we were going to no longer try to grow corn in Montana because we didn't have sprinklers and we didn't have farmers insurance. And so And we learned from the other tribes that were here, like the Blackfeet, how to live here on the Great Plains. And, you know, one of the things that we learned and that we do very similar to them, we have our own traditional stories about where we got the teepee. But our teepee is very similar to the Blackfeet and the Shoshone. And that, and those are some ancient tribes here in Montana. My tribe, the Apsalaga, the Crow tribe, we're probably the last, or the first, I guess, woodlands tribe to occupy the Great Plains. We came, there was already people here living in teepees. And they set their teepees up by starting with four poles. And those four poles represent everything about the medicine wheel. The four directions, the four seasons, the circle of life. And that's ancient way of thinking about that teepee, when you set up that teepee. And my tribe adopted that way. The tribes that came later onto the Great Plains, I'm talking about in the 1700s and 1800s when the horse came along and they came along with it, they got wise to the fact that you don't need to start with four, you can just use three. So if you look at Lakota style or Northern Cheyenne, a lot of these tribes that came a little later in the colonization of the Great Plains, they used three poles. And, you know, I think there's a lot of symbolism there, but again, it kind of speaks to the fact that the ancient way of doing things was in a circular way and representing the four directions, always acknowledging them. And so the Yellowstone River and the place names along the river kind of tell the story of the history of my tribe, not just the place where the corn died, but this here, Hide Scraper. It was such a prominent landmark that every tribe knew of it. And this was the Elk River here. And in fact, the Salish, who would come from the west out onto to the plains to hunt and trade, knew this river as Hide Scraper River. That was one of the names that they had for the Elk River. Of course, now we know it as Yellowstone. So the place names can tell us a lot about the people and their culture. It was a hide scraper because that's what they did for their living. They scraped hides. And by scraping hides, by taking care of those hides, by tanning them, by softening them, by making them beautifully white in the sun, by stitching them and sewing them together perfectly, by decorating them beautifully, now you have a product that is not just something that is desirable for yourself and your children and your loved ones, but also something that you can trade. Because in the heart of the Great Plains, you're in the center of a trade network that stretches literally from coast to coast. And that was one of the most important things about the Great Plains culture, was the cosmopolitan nature of how the Plains Indians interacted with one another. We've been stereotyped as constantly at war with one another. But the fact is, we lived here for over 12,000 years with no horses. And all of the culture that we developed during that time was not based on warfare. Because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if you don't have any horses and everyone's on foot, going in and attacking a camp is not that smart of a move. For one thing, those folks are already rested. They've been sitting there in camp. You can't try and run away from them, right? I mean, it just gets downright silly and funny when you start to think about it, doesn't it? The horse era changed. It tipped the balance of power in so many different ways here on the Great Plains. But I have this, I wanted to play this clip, and I don't know, since I'm not on the internet, I suppose it's not going to work, huh? This is a video that, it's only about a minute and a half long. You can find it on YouTube. It's the 1930 Plains Indian Sign Language Conference. And there's at least a couple different videos that you can watch. All the different Plains Indians got together in 1930 in Browning, and it was videotaped. They were invited. Their way was paid for by the National Park Service. And they all spoke in sign language. What is so remarkable about that? I would say that it is the most astonishing and most, the single greatest achievement of Plains Indian culture. And I would say that there's really never been anything like it. And when you go back to prehistory, in the days before people had cell phones and telephones and stuff like that, when people actually had to speak with one another without microphones and stuff like that, there was no geographic area in the world where people spoke such a common lingua franca. You're talking about 44 different groups that spoke one common language going from Canada down to Mexico. From the Rocky Mountains all the way out into the Mississippi River. How is it, if all these people did was fight with one another, that they would learn how to speak a language that was common? And if you go and you study so many of the stories of my tribe and of the Plains tribes, and of course, with the Medicine Wheel, we know of the star stories are probably the most significant, the most noteworthy, the most enduring, the most prominent stories are star stories. And why wouldn't they be? Because we spend a great deal of time with the stars here in Montana. It's a long winter, and there's no trees to block the view. And so if you look at the star stories, there's one story I like to share with folks, the story of the superpower twins. And that story is shared by pretty much every tribe from Canada all the way down to Colorado, at least. Every place in that medicine wheel country that we find the wheels, the people who lived in a circular way. And the story of those twins, the names of the twins, the deeds that they did, the constellation, Orion, which is symbolizes a woman's hand that they cut off and threw into the sky, an evil woman who killed their mother. That story is word for word identical in at least five different language families, not just languages within that specific family, but I'm talking about Shoshone, Crow, Blackfeet. These are three families that are completely separate, different, and all have that story word for word the same. And so you have to ask yourself, from an anthropological point of view, how did that come to be? There was an awful lot of communication. This story here reveals a lot that this particular man is telling. He's a Northern Cheyenne, and he's telling a story, and it's a funny story. And it reveals their disposition, reveals his humorous disposition, and there's two fellows that are sitting right next to him. They laugh very easily. They have a lot of fun while they're talking to each other, while not saying a word. And it tells you something again about the nature of the culture on the Great Plains. It was a circular culture. It valued balance. It valued coming together, sitting on the ground in a circle, as individuals, no one any better, no one any worse, and sharing space together. And those are the values that I gleaned from watching this and being around this type of culture. Balance is all throughout my tribe. Again, a few more stories. You can see in our artwork, we value balance, symmetry. and a color balance as well. And we like to, you know, these I believe are probably copies of the constellation, like I was just talking about Orion. This could be Orion's belt in here. A lot of these symbols that we see look like night sky symbols, or symbols that come from nature that are balanced, that are whole. And that idea is very important to the Crow people. You see it in the clan system. We have teasing clan and we have praising traditions. And everyone gets teased and everyone gets praised, no matter who you are. And that's a way to keep you balanced, to not let you think you're too good or that you're too bad. Giving you an opportunity to enjoy the full human experience. Gender equality is also historically prominent. One of the best stories that an early trader told about the Crow tribe was back in 1805. His name was Antoine La Roche, and he was a French fur trader. And he was really the first non-Indian to spend time with my tribe, the Crow Indians. And he met up with them in 1805. He was up at the camps of the Hidatsa and Mandan. And Lewis and Clark were there as well. What a coincidence. And so Lewis and Clark, they wanted to get out early that spring because they had a lot of stuff they wanted to get done. And Antoine La Roche said, well, hey, since you guys are heading west, how about if I tag along with you? And, we can help each other out. And they were quite matter-of-fact, sternly told them, well, first of all, you're trespassing, you know, because this is America, and you're Frenchmen. And second of all, we're not out here day sailing or anything. You know, this is a serious military expedition that we're on. No, you're not welcome to come along with us. They kind of read him the Riot Act, and so in his journals, he kind of had a thing or two to say about Lewis and Clark. They had grand plans, according to La Roche. And La Roche was a very good writer. He kept impeccable notes. He wrote almost every single day he spent with the Crow Indians. He spent 4 months with them. And during that time, he traveled 1,400 miles on horseback. One of the most remarkable things about that whole statistic is that they picked him up at the Mandan and Hidatsa camps in June of 1805. And he rode with them on horseback back to the Bighorn Mountains, spent the summer in this region, and then in September, August, they took him all the way back up to the Mandan Hidatsa camps at present-day Newtown, North Dakota. So he traveled 1,400 miles, but they traveled 2,800 miles at least, because they had to go all the way up to pick him up, then come back, and then take him back home again, and then come back again. So you can imagine they were doing a lot of traveling. These people weren't sitting still for very long. One of the stories that La Roche tells about his time with the Crow Indians is the time that they made it to the Bighorn Mountains back in their home territory that they said. He says, well, the Crows say they're back in their home territory. And the men wanted to go out for a hunt, so he was prepared to go out for them, a hunt with them. And so the next morning they get out to go, and their wives, their girlfriends, or their significant others had left at some point in the night. And so this was something that La Roche was stunned by. And so the leader of the hunting party says, well, you know, we're going to change our plans. I know where those women went, you know. We're going to go follow these women. And La Roche says, well, you know, he had no idea what was going on, but apparently the group acquiesced because he was the leader, and so they go off on a different direction. And they go off for a day, and they spend the night. And then the next morning, La Roche says, the men gather up in a circle, and they approach the leader, and apparently they tell the leader, you know, we don't like this plan. We already had plans. And we wanted to go over in this other direction. And I know, you know, those women are over here, going over here, but we decided we wanted to go back the other way anyway. And the Rosh says that the leader of that war party, of that little group of men, immediately says, all right. And he acquiesces and he allows them to pick a new leader, and they change course and head in a different direction. All that whole chain of events was stunning to LaRoche. He couldn't decide what was more remarkable. The women taking off, then the men chasing him down, or the fact that the guys pulled a mutiny on the leader and then the leader acquiesced and then they all went in a different direction. But what he was witnessing was the type of democracy that all of us know about in Montana. And that is, you do what you want and everybody else can figure it out. And if they don't like it, then I guess they can do something about it. But in the meantime, we all have to act on our own accord. And it's no offense to anybody, right? It's just doing as we are, because we're not subservient and we're not beholden. And those women took off, the Rosh understood, because they could and they wanted to. And they had their own horses, and they had their own houses. And if they wanted a divorce, that was fine, because they could economically support themselves. So he had entered into a realm where the economy was a completely different reality in the human culture. And that tipped the balance of power, not just in terms of gender, but in so many different ways with the natural world. And now, finally, just a few minutes to go here, my theory on public lands, since, of course, you know, it is election day, and I've got 1 hour to go and vote now. This land here is all public. It's always been public, you know, for 13,000 years. The only thing that's not public is these little waterways where people spend the winter. Winter campsites, because you can't just pitch your tent out here in the Judith Gap with no water around and expect to make it through the winter. There was enough buffalo, and there was enough grass, and there was enough resources in this area here that all these tribes traveled and traded all throughout one another's so-called territory that we see all the time. That was just expected and part of the natural way of the world. But what was not natural was when you went into somebody's house and said, I like this place, and I'm going to set up my teepees here now. And so I think in Montana we see those same things holding true to today. We like to share things. We like to share the land. We believe in our independence as individuals, as communities. And a lot of that is because, again, of our economic reality. Of course, for a lot of us, our economic reality is we take a big pay cut to stay in the state because there's some things, of course, that money can't buy. You know, again, those are values that have been here for a very long time. Without the money, the people, of course, built up in the surplus elsewhere in the world. The things that folks cared about here, especially my tribe and other tribes of the region, was their spiritual capital and how they could gather that and how they could use it and what they could use it for and how it would benefit themselves and their communities. And again, that was done in a balanced way all the time. And I'm going to finish up here because we're at the end of the hour. But I wanted to kind of make a point with a few visual displays. Abraham Maslow, famous educator, all of us who took education courses here at MSU read his stuff. He came up with a hierarchy of needs. What we didn't find out, though, in our education classes was that he spent a lot of time with the Canadian Crees. And, in fact, went to their sun dances and hung out with them and was looking for personalities in the Cree community. He's looking for individuals, displays of whatever it was that they had. You know, I mean, was it anger? Was it kindness? What kind of traits did this community have? And one thing he noted about that community was that he believed that there was more self-actualized people in that community than any place he'd ever been. And he developed his theory of self-actualization up there. I mean, a lot of what he saw in that Cree community, he instilled in his theory of self-actualization. And of course it's a pyramid. Like so many things, like so many empires, you know, the pyramids in Egypt, the pyramids, the Mayan pyramids, the ones in Cahokia. And it's difficult for us, I think, in Western culture to get away from this pyramid because it makes so much sense and it's reflected in everywhere around us. You know, here's the billionaires up here and this is me down here. I came from a single-parent mother who never graduated high school, never went further than her sophomore year. Literally, I grew up in beneath poverty. But I never felt it. And I always had the Bighorn Mountains, the Crazy Mountains, these other public lands. And like John Denver said, you know, feel like a millionaire. But I think it's ironic, though, that he were to take the values of this circle here and put them into this format, rather than just using that same format that he saw time and again with the Cree people, the most basic and simple element in nature, the one that all of us long for in our own lives is the balance that this circle represents. You know, we want to have a work balance, we want to have a play, we want to have family balance. We want to have balance in our ages. You know, we want to be around young people. You know, we segregate our ages in this culture in so many different ways. And so there's all these different forms of balance that we seek. How do we find them? Well, I guess I'll leave that up to you. But you know, we could probably start with ceremony and see where we can go from there. So I guess I'm going to wrap things up there. At 7:03, I'll take a few questions if you have any. I know people need to get home. So thank you so much for coming. Appreciate it very much.